Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Super Bowl Sunday to everybody. I'm looking forward to watching the game. I don't know about you guys. Very American thing to do, particularly for us immigrants. For those of you listening live, you can also watch it on Facebook Live. We are streaming, and it should work today because it's at home. So I've got a good internet connection, so everything should be working fine. Also, to remind you, I mean, to some extent, you guys can dictate the topics we talk about on this show by calling in and asking questions. It's kind of open mic. You can ask questions about anything. Those of you who want me to talk more about philosophy, call up and ask a philosophical question. Those of you who want me to talk about something that I don't usually talk about, call and ask. If I don't have an opinion, which is pretty unusual, I'll tell you that I don't have an opinion. All right, 347-324-3075. 347-324-3075. Today, we are talking about American nationalism or economic nationalism versus America. So the idea here is, I would argue that American nationalism, economic nationalism, nationalism as a concept is anti-American. But what I want to do first is I want to talk about the positive first. People have argued, and I think somewhat legitimately, that all I do, I criticize Trump, but I don't present my own positive views about it, or that I spend the beginning of the show criticizing Trump, and then kind of my solutions or my answers to these problems or these issues or these is at the end of the show, and people paying less attention to that, and it comes across as overly negative. So let's start with a positive question to all of you. What is America? What does it mean to talk about America? Now, in a sense, America's, United States of America is a particular country with particular borders, a particular geographic area. It provides citizenship based on certain standards. So it's the citizens of America. So America is this geographic place. And that's all true, but is that what really makes America America? What is it that defines America and makes it exceptional? Because I am a true believer in American exceptionalism, that there's something different about America, that America is a different kind of place, given the borders, given everything else, a different kind of place than any other place on the planet, any other country. And as you know, as many of you know, I'm an immigrant. So, I chose to come to America for a particular reason, not because it's beautiful. It's a gorgeous country, but there are other gorgeous countries. China is amazingly beautiful. South Africa is amazingly beautiful. Canada, if you don't go when it's so cold, you can't really breathe, is a beautiful country. But what makes America unique, or what has made America unique through its history? Because I'm going to argue that to a large extent, we're losing and have been losing what America is and what makes America special. So what is it? What is it? And a lot of people say, it's the Constitution. It's the founding principles, but in some sense, and that's all true. But what are those principles? What are the principles that animate the Constitution of the United States? What is the principle that animates the Declaration of Independence? What are the founding principles? And to what extent do those principles still survive today? To what extent is America still that America? Because to me, it is. America is the founding idea of America. America is a particular moral idea, ethical idea. It's not an economic idea. It's not even a political idea. It is fundamentally an ethical idea. It's about morality. And indeed, Ayn Rand said America was the first country in human history founded on a moral, ethical principle. It's a moral ethical principle. And what is that moral ethical principle? What is the principle that makes America different than any other country in the world? What is, why did Ayn Rand call it the first, that was basically founded? Because remember, even at its founding, there was a real sin at the heart of it, right? And that sin at the heart of it was certainly slavery and a lot of other things that the founders did that were wrong. But at its core, its essence, and what made, I think, America great, was a moral ethical principle, right? And I want to contrast that. I want to contrast that today, spend at least some of the show today contrasting that with the concept of America as presented by left and right in American politics today, as presented by, what Obama and Trump, the contrast between the two, right? And why I think both are fundamentally anti-American and fundamentally different, fundamentally antagonistic to the very essence, the very idea of what America is and what America stood for and what the founding principles really are about. And particularly with regard to Trump, I want to talk about this idea of economic nationalism, which is really, I think, animating and is going to animate, in spite of people not believing that Trump will actually do what he says. I think he actually will do what he said. It really is animated his campaign and is really animating the first few weeks of his administration. And we'll see where it goes from here, but certainly all signs suggest that this is at the top of his agenda. So what is the moral principle? What is the moral principle that was unique to America and still is unique to America, because there's still no other country that has elevated this principle to the place in which America has? And certainly no other country was founded on this idea. No other country fought a revolution to establish this idea. So it's fundamentally the idea of individualism. It's fundamentally the idea of the primacy of the individual. So before America, if you ask the question, who does your life belong to? Who does your life belong to? I'm still a little jet lagged, right? Who does your life belong to? It was always to the tribe, to the group, to the collective, to the king, to the witch doctor, to the pope, or to God. But your life certainly never, maybe with the possible exception of Greece, ancient Greece, your life never belonged in any kind of fundamental sense to yourself, to you, right? So the fundamental question is, your life, what moral status does your life have? And again, throughout most of human history, with exception of Greece, the moral status your life had was as a sacrificial animal, sacrificed to the tribe in tribal societies, sacrificed to God in a Christian society, sacrifice to the king, to the Fuhrer, to the proletarian in a variety of different collectivistic societies. But almost all of human history places the group, the collective, and define the group differently every time, right? And of course, when we say sacrifice to a king, the king representing the nation, representing the state. So it's, again, it's really you're sacrificing to the state, with the king being the representative of that state, representative of that group. So the fundamental always has been the individual is just a sacrificial animal to some other greater good. And think about that. It's always been your life is at the mercy of a greater good. It's the greater good that's important. And the greater good, again, fill in the blank what that greater good is going to be. And think about how politicians today, even in America, talk about this. And put aside Trump, but almost every politician, whether it was George Bush or McCain or Clinton or Trump or Obama, all of them always call you as an individual, or whether it was JFK, to fight, to live for, to dedicate your life to some kind of greater good. Some kind of greater good. So you as an individual don't ultimately count, or you don't count as much as some other good, you know, whether it's helping the poor, or whether it's going to the moon, or whether it's the great state of America, or whether it's this, you know, or whether it's some religious cause, whatever it is, you know, the greater good is what counts. And remember McCain coming out of the National Convention, the Republican National Convention in 2008 with the slogan, country first, right? The greater good in that case was country. And that resonated with a lot of Americans. And I think Trump has capitalized on something that, in a sense, McCain, supposedly the enemy of Trump, laid the foundation of. And indeed, conservatism and much of the American right, much of American republicanism and the conservatism over the last, 50 years, really since the defeat of Barry Goldwater, has laid the foundations for Trump, has reoriented us away from individualism towards nationalism, away towards the idea, if you will, towards the idea that the individual at the end of the day doesn't count. And neoconservatism is the same thing. The purpose, according to neoconservatism, of American the individual is to sacrifice for the American state. And if you're interested in neoconservatism in particular, I would encourage you to read Brad Thompson's book, which I am a minor co-author, helped with some of the chapters on neoconservatism and Obituary for an Idea, which is an excellent presentation of the evil of neoconservatism and how it's not just neoconservatism, it's a broader umbrella of Straussianism, which has impacted the right and really made the right collectivistic. And Brad actually identifies neoconservatism and Straussians as basically paving the road to fascism, and I would argue paving the road to Donald Trump, who ultimately is paving the road to fascism. So Trump is not a isolated, kind of out of nowhere, hard to understand phenomena. This is where the American right has been heading for a very long time. And again, I think that if you read the book, Neoconservatism and Obituary for an Idea, available on Amazon, you will see that Brad and I, to some extent, forecast this. We show the path towards it. And the whole idea there is the American collective, the mystical American spirit that we're all supposed to sacrifice towards. And when you read David Brooks has this, and actually David Brooks had a fascinating op-ed, and maybe when I take a break, I'll bring that up on, I'll find it in the New York Times about Trump. But it's interesting, you know, what David Brooks is upset about is that Donald Trump's collectivistic vision for America is different than David Brooks's collectivistic vision for America. That David Brooks's collectivistic vision for America is about globalism, is about spreading democracy, it's about sacrificing American individuals for the sake of the freedom of Iraqis and people all over the world. And Donald Trump's form of collectivism is more, you know, for lack of a better word, it's more nationalistic in a sense of isolationism in some way. So David Brooks wants us to sacrifice for the world. Donald Trump just wants us to sacrifice for Americans. But both are collectivistic, competing collectivistic visions. And certainly in modern times, certainly the modern conservative movement, with a possible exception of Barry Goldwater, has been a collectivist movement, and Donald Trump has just capitalized on that collectivism. They have softened the people. They have softened the Republican Party to the point where they're willing to embrace kind of Donald Trump as a symbol. And in a sense, what you see in the election of Donald Trump is people rejecting the neoconservative version of collectivism for the sake of a Donald Trump economic nationalism form of collectivism. That is really the choice that Americans have been presented with. And what is lacking, what has been lacking since Goldwater, and even Goldwater didn't have this completely, is a American candidate, is an American vision for America, is a founding father's ideology around which Americans could get excited. And that is an individualistic ideology. So what is America? America is individualism. What is America? America is the idea, the moral idea, that your life is yours and that the state is there only to protect you from coercion from others. It's to arbitrate dispute and protect you, and that's it. And as a consequence, it's your moral responsibility to take care of your life. It's your moral duty to strive towards achievement of happiness. Duty is the wrong word, but your moral responsibility. That's what morality is about. And that you have an inalienable right, which means you are free to pursue whatever values you deem necessary for your own survival and happiness and flourishing. And that it's your responsibility to achieve those values. It's your responsibility to strive towards those values. And it's your responsibility when you fail to achieve those values. It's your responsibility to pick yourself up and try again. It's not your neighbors, and it's certainly not government's moral responsibility to prop you up. So the whole idea of America is about individual moral responsibility for your own happiness. Not individual responsibility in the kind of superficial conservative sense, which ultimately what they want you to do is sacrifice for some greater cause than yourself. No, you are the cause. You are what you should be fighting for. You are what you should be living for. Your own happiness, your own well-being, your own flourishing as a human being is what America was created to facilitate. And it's to facilitate the ability of virtuous people to succeed. So America is there to make it possible for you to exercise your reason, to exercise your rational faculty, to achieve, to be productive, to go out there and be an entrepreneur, to build, to create, or be productive in any way you can. It is a country that was created in order to facilitate productiveness as a virtue, because it is a country that was created in order to facilitate reason, rational thinking as a virtue. So what America is about creating the proper legal environment, where your rights are protected in such a way that the rational person in America can go out there and achieve and succeed, that there are no barriers, artificial, coercive barriers to individual human achievement. If you are rational, if you are productive, there are no guarantees. So if you're irrational and if you're not willing to be productive, then you will fail in America. Good, America says. We are the land of virtue, not of vice. We are the land of rationality, of independence, of productiveness, not of irrationality, laziness, entitlement. And we are not a nation first. But where the nation exists only for the purpose of defending and protecting the individual. And this is partially a consequence of, it was easier to do in America in a sense than it was do in Europe. It was easier to start from nothing, to start fresh, to unshackle yourself from all the collectivistic ideologies and chains that were placed on one in Europe. To some extent, to survive in America back then, you had to have this spirit because it was a frontier. Nature provided that challenge and that corrective measure. If you were lazy on the frontier, you just couldn't survive. So that frontier mentality, that ability to start fresh, to start new, that ability to shrug off everything European, to shrug off aristocracy, to shrug off entitlement, to shrug off collectivism is what made America unique, what made America great, what made America a moral country, because it was the first country set up to defend individual virtue, to defend the virtuous, defend reason, to leave people alone so they could live a virtuous life, basically, right? And that, no other country did that. No other country was established for that purpose. The French Revolution was not fought. It said productive, rational people could achieve happiness and flourishing in their lives. It was fought much more out of hatred. Now, maybe a legitimate hatred of the aristocrats who were exploiting people, but much more out of hatred, much more out of class envy, much more out of the idea of, and ultimately the idea of egalitarianism, of equality, not just equality before the law, not just equality of rights, equality of liberty, equality of freedom, but equality of outcome. It was much more about smashing than about building. The American Revolution is the real revolution. It's the real new thing. And to the extent that countries all over the world, to whatever extent they have, adopted elements out of the American Revolution, out of the spirit of individualism, out of the spirit of you own your life, you're responsible for your life, and your moral purpose in life is your own individual happiness, to the extent countries adopted that. And I believe that much of the West adopted these ideas during the 19th century politically. And even the East in the 20th century adopted these ideas to some extent, to some minimal, limited extent. But to the extent that they did that, that is the extent to which these countries have flourished, have prospered, have grown. Now, one of the things that this whole view, and I promise I will get your phone calls, and somebody from, I guess, Austin, 512, has been on the line since I started the show, so he's eager to ask a question. I promise to get to that. And by the way, if you're calling in, press 1 so that I know that you want to ask a question versus just calling in to listen to the show. Some people just call in to listen to the show. But if you want to ask a question, you have to press the 1 button. So one of the things that individualism that you have to understand, that individualism as a folk, as this idea that the individual is the primary, means that every economic, political that comes up, cultural issue, needs to be examined and viewed and thought about from the perspective of the individual. So, for example, when people talk about trade, and we've talked about this before on the show, but it's worth repeating because, and particularly in the context of economic nationalism, they talk about America is running a trade deficit with China, and put aside China because China always complicates things. Okay, because Donald Trump has now made a big deal about the fact that we have a trade deficit in automobiles with Germany. So we have a trade deficit with Germany. And America trades with Germany. And as an individualist, and the way Americans have always thought about this and should think about this is no. I don't know what a trade deficit even means. Because I own a German car because I want to buy a German car. It's in my self-interest. It's in my pursuit of my individual flourishing to buy a German car. Whose business is that? And so I bought a car from Germany. I have a massive trade deficit with Germany because I don't think I do anything. You know, once in a while I go talk in Germany, but that's it. You know, nothing close to how much money I spend on German products. My Audi costs a lot of money. So all my talks in Germany don't add up to the value of the Audi. So I, Yaron Brook, have a huge trade deficit with Germany. Great. I don't care. Who cares? What difference does it make to me? What difference does it make to you? Makes no difference to you. And what business is it of yours? What business is it of my neighbor? And, you know, because I bought a car in Germany, it could be that in a car, because a lot of us do that, it could be that some American auto company goes out of business. So what? So what is the individualistic answer? I am not responsible, and neither is my government, for the existence of any particular company, for the existence of any particular job. And that auto worker who loses his job, he doesn't have a right to that job. He doesn't have a right to a job. He certainly doesn't have a right to that specific job. He loses that job, then, you know, do what everybody else does. And what we've always done in American history when we lose a job, what do? We pack up our stuff and go look for another job. And that sometimes, often, has meant that we had to move to a different place in a different county or a different state or a different part of the United States. And to the extent there's an individualist, we are concerned because it looks like the economic policy of the United States government is restricting my standard of living, is restricting the number of jobs that exist out there. To that extent, we should complain to the United States government about its policies that restrict jobs. But what does that mean? It cannot mean that it gets to tell me that I can't buy a car from Germany. What it means is that there are too many controls, too many constraints. The government is spending too much of its effort and time and energy on restricting the ability of people to pursue their flourishing, to engage in reason and engage in productiveness. And how do they do that? They do that through massive regulation and massive tax burden. They take our money away from us, so we can't use that money to actually pursue our own businesses or actually pursue our own flourishing or actually buy the things that make our lives better. Instead, they take it to use for the national good. They regulate us. They tell us what and how. I posted this article on Facebook. This is the article, right? The article was, wow, what a great victory we have in, I can't remember if it's South Dakota or North Dakota. This is the Institute of Justice, an organization I love and that does amazing, amazing work on behalf of individualism. And the Institute for Justice have won this major battle. The state of South Dakota no longer requires a license to braid hair. That's how pathetic the United States of America has become, where the government is regulating braiding hair, and when we, the advocates of individualism, view getting rid of those licensing requirements as a major victory. Now, I'm not diminishing the work that IJ does on the country. Huge admirer. And if they can get rid of licensing and braiding hair, that's going to, you know, hopefully lead to getting rid of a lot of licensing laws. But the very idea, right, the American government, not the European governments, not in China, not in Germany, not in France, not in Israel, but in America, you need a license to braid hair. To the extent that we are frustrated economically because we look around and there are not as many jobs as we think are possible, and our standard of living is not increasing, and there's distortions in the allocation of wealth, and we look and we see that government is doing all these things, they are to blame. And it's not just government as an abstraction to blame. It's all of us are to blame. And this is the opposite of Donald Trump's campaign, right? We are to blame because we vote these bastards in. We are to blame because we accept that, oh, no, you want to shrink government, but like the Tea Party said, keep your hands off of my Medicare. Well, what do you think Medicare is? The largest redistribution of wealth in human history. That's what Medicare is, from young people to old people. So we are to blame. It's not the fault of foreigners. It's not the fault of Mexicans. It's not the fault of immigrants. We, Americans, have been voting these bastards in who are regulating, controlling, taxing our lives. And we actually support those policies. And then when things get rough and we don't like the jobs that we have, we blame people overseas. Now, that's the economic nationalism that Donald Trump is capitalizing on. And that is exactly the opposite of what America stood for. America was always about taking personal responsibility. We screwed up. We, as individual Americans, have screwed up. We have voted for people who gave us Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and regulate hair braiding and regulate every aspect of American business and give us Dodd-Frank and you've given us Sarbanes-Oxley and you know, Glass-Steagall. And this has been going on for over 100 years. And we've got a Federal Reserve that is redistributing wealth by artificially manipulating interest rates and manipulating the supply of money. And you could go on and on and on. We Americans need to take responsibility for that as individuals and undo the mess. But you see, it's much easier. It's so much easier. And it feels so much better to blame those other guys, to blame somebody else. It's those frigging immigrants. It's all their fault. It's the Chinese. Oh, no, not just the Chinese, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Mexicans, the Germans. Just fill in the blank. And that's economic nationalism, the essence of economic nationalism. The essence of economic nationalism, I mean, is to place the nation above the individual. But the way in which you convince people to adopt economic nationalism is to tell them that other people at fault with all their problems. And if only we could take care of those other people, everything would be great. Everything would be great. All right. I'm going to take a break in the sense that I'm going to take a couple of phone calls. And then I want to talk about economic nationalism, what it signifies, and then how it is manifest in the Trump administration. And then I want to talk about a couple of things that Donald Trump has done in the last few weeks. People are complaining at me that I never see the positives, that I don't talk about Trump's positives. So I'm going to talk about the positives. Now, you'll see that I don't view them as positives. All the wonderful things Trump has done over the last 2 weeks, that I see negatives even when other people see positives. Sorry, guys. It's just the way I am. I'm objective. And I want to ask you some questions about if Obama had done the same thing as some of what Donald Trump is doing, whether you would have cheered him as much, whether you would have cheered as much. All right. But let's start with a phone call. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hello?
512 area code.
Yaron, you can you hear me?
I can hear you. Just speak up a little bit. You're a little soft.
Okay, it's Tom Mann down in Austin, and
hi Tom. Okay, so I'm getting to your question. Can we hold off, or do you want me?
Yeah, we can hold off
now. What's that?
Yeah, we can hold off.
Okay, so I've got it in writing. You can, you know, if I don't answer it, you can. Well, you know what? Let's just do it because you're on the line. Let's just do it. So Tom wrote me a very thoughtful question coming out of last week's show. And I thought it was a really good question, and it's a kind of question that I get a lot of, and so I wanted to answer him, and I emailed him and said I want to take on this question, and Tom agreed to have his name mentioned as that. So I'm going to read what Tom wrote me, and I'm going to intersperse it with my answers, and then Tom, you can follow up with anything more that you want to ask. That make sense?
Yes.
Okay. Great. Okay, so Tom says, I agree with you that Iran should have been nuked out of existence in 79-80. I actually never said that, but we get the spirit. Whether you use nukes or not, they should have been crushed in 79-80. Ayatollah Khomeini should have been gone. The fact that they took our hostages was an act of war, and we should have engaged with them and crushed them. And the whole Middle East today would be a completely different thing. By the way, I believe strongly that if that had happened in 79-80, they'd been Al-Qaeda, they'd been ISIS. The whole idea of Islamic totalitarianism would have been discredited. Iran's survival and, in a sense, thriving since 1979, what is it now, almost 40 years, is really emboldened the Islamist cause. Okay, and that Trump is an idiot. So Tom at least agrees with me, and Trump's an idiot. But your solution that Congress should declare war on Islamic terrorists and countries like Iran and Saudi Arabia is correct, yet totally implausible. How likely is it that this Congress or any Congress in our lifetime is going to do that? In order to get any kind of consensus for that, you'd have to have a philosophical revolution in this country that discards any kind of altruism and proudly asserts America's right to be a secular nation that is wealthy and enjoys the fruit of material success. I don't see that happening anytime soon. All right. So let me take it up to this point. I agree with everything Tom has written here. He's absolutely right. The likelihood that Congress is going to declare war in the way I suggest is as close to zero as one could imagine. And everything he says here, what we need is to return to America, what I've been talking about, what Americanism is. We need to return to that or reestablish that. And that's science fiction. Whether it happens in our lifetime would be wonderful. But let me just pause here and say this in a sense of my goal. Right, what is my goal on the Yaron Brooks show? My goal is not to offer you solutions in what we should do in the next 2 years. That's not my goal. So, and now I will provide that. And in this context, I'm going to give you some things that I think can be done in the next 4 years that are politically doable. But my job as a commentator, my job as a cultural analyst and somebody who talks hopefully philosophically about the world is not to provide practical solutions that are implementable in this philosophical culture in the next 2 to 4 years. You know, I think that's futile because they've got a wrong philosophy. So everything they're going to do is going to be wrong. What I want to do and what I strive to do and what I think we don't have at all in the world in which we live in is somebody who tells you what it should look like, what should happen, what the ideal looks like. Because the only way we'll ever get to the ideal is if we name it, talk about it, advocate for it, push for it, constantly harp on the ideal. So that when politicians get into power, they know there's a voice out there for an ideal that they kind of, because a lot of people, I speak to a lot of audiences about this foreign policy, and I get standing ovation every time I say, crush them, let's declare war. People want to believe this, right? So, but they need to hear it. My job is to voice that. And I believe that if we voice that, the country will slowly move in that direction. Now, you can't just voice that alone. You have to give it the philosophical foundation in egoism and in reason that it requires. And hopefully I continue to do that. I don't just talk about politics. We're talking today about what America is, which is basically a moral philosophical foundation. But if nobody voices that, crush them, declare war, then we'll never get that. So my job is to say that, not to say, given the altruism of American culture today, here are the steps that we can take. Given the altruism, the culture today, let me be very clear in my views. Everything we do is going to backfire. And this relates to the second part of Tom's question. So let me go on to the end. And at the end, I'm going to let you chime in, Tom. Meanwhile, what do we do right now to counter the threat of Islamic terrorism? Trump's temporary ban on Muslims is a step in the right direction, though he should have provided exemptions for Muslims who aided us in war and included the Saudis and Emirates in the ban, along with Pakistan, etc. This call for extreme vetting is a laudable goal if he can get someone in a state of honor to define what it is in the next 4 months. And his refusal to allow refugees from Syria is a good thing. There's no way to properly vet them. So some of what he wants to do is good. Yes, and I said that on the show. I'm for extreme vetting. My concern is this part. If he can get someone in the State Department to define what it is. Because if you read the executive order actually wants to vet people on their understanding of the founding principles of America. That scares the bejesus out of me. This is where, because this is altruism, because this is politics in the world in which we live in today, you're giving a powerful tool to the government. I'm admitting we have to do it to some extent or another. But we're giving this vetting tool to the government. I'm worried that vetting tool will be turned around on me and on people like me. And when I want to immigrate to the United States, which I already have, luckily, I'm going to be said, Yaron, you don't understand the original principles of the United States. The original principles didn't mean individualism. Now, that's not coming today, and it's not going to happen tomorrow. But 10 years from now, this executive order might be used for exactly that. I do not want ideological screening. I want it clearly defined, clearly applicable to Islam, clearly applicable to violence, not to ideas, but to the promotion of violence. And if they can do that, I'll be for the extreme vetting. The way the ban was done cannot be separated from the essence of the ban. This is exactly people trying to do kind of the right thing, but they're altruists. So they can't get it right. They can't actually say who the good guys and the bad guys are because that would be too self-interested. So they kind of flounder. They exclude good people and they ban, you know, some good people are not going to get in. They have to make it an umbrella and then they make it too sweeping. And then, of course, they can't go after the Saudis because Saudis are so-called our friends. And if they identified the Saudis as an enemy, that would create all kinds of problems. Only a individualist could actually name the Saudis as an enemy. I bet you anything this administration will never do that. So it's a half-assed proposal, a half-assed ban that is not going to lead, in my view, to anything productive and good, and could dangerously lead to something very, very bad. And let me give you an example of where I was wrong in accepting a half measure as moving in the right direction, and it backfired amazingly on me. So this is in 2002, after 9/11. You know, the Ayn Rand Institute was strongly advocating for war against Iran and Saudi Arabia. We put out 4-page ads in the New York Times and the Washington Post. I was on television advocating for this. We wrote about it. I spoke all over the country around this. But nobody was listening, right? Nobody was listening, including many objectivists. But nobody listens. And then it was clear that Bush was going to launch a war in Iraq. And I came to the conclusion back then that it was better to do a war in Iraq than not to do anything. That the worst thing America could do was be perceived as accepting 9/11 as just happening. And maybe if we engage in a war in Iraq, it would lead ultimately to us going after the Iranians. And of course, I was completely wrong. I think the war in Iraq was a disaster that led to much worse consequences than not doing anything. I think if we'd stayed home, things would have been much better. 5,000 Americans ultimately died for nothing, worse than nothing. They died for ISIS, for the creation of an ISIS. George W. Bush turned out to be even more pathetically weak than I thought he was. The surge, we actually paid money to Sunnis not to fight us, money that landed up funding ISIS and creating ISIS. So a measure that I thought was better than nothing turned out to be much, much worse than nothing. And so I'm now very cautious about recommending things when I know that the people who are going to implement it are as nutty as they are today. So today I would not advise going to war with Iraq, given who's going to execute the war. Today I worry about a ban because I know who's going to execute that ban. I worry about these things, and I'm going to talk out against them. And again, I am going to say, this is what should be done. I know you're not going to do it. But you know what? This is what should be done. I'm going to tell it to audiences all over the world and all over the country. And hopefully we move people slowly towards what is ideal. I know none of this is going to happen probably in my lifetime. But I think that if there's any hope for objectivism someday, then we have to start moving them. Okay, second part also is good. Also, I think you're a bit blasé about the terrorist attacks in Orlando and San Bernardino. If they continue, the American people are going to accept police state a lot sooner than you and I would want. Well, neither of us would ever want the police state, so that's just bad grammar there. We have to infiltrate the Wahhabi mosque and crack down on imams who preach violence. I agree. So I would never want to come across as blasé about terrorist attacks like Orlando and San Bernardino. And if I did, I apologize, right? That was a mistake. My point was that as awful and as evil as Orlando and San Bernardino terrorist attacks were, the ban wouldn't have stopped them, one, because the woman in San Bernardino came from Saudi Arabia. The man was born in America, and in Orlando, the man was born in America. And his parents came from Afghanistan, I think, if I'm right. And Afghanistan isn't on the ban. So none of this is relevant. But more than that, I believe we should look at Orlando and San Bernardino objectively. They are awful, horrific. I think we should infiltrate Wahhabi mosques. I've called for that since 9/11. And not just Wahhabi mosques. I think Shiite mosques as well, because who knows what the Iranians and what Hezbollah are doing in the Shiite mosques today in America. I think we have to crack down on these imams. I've said all along, while I object to the NSA listening to all of our phone calls, they should be profiling. They should be looking at radicals. They should be, and if they have to listen to all Muslims, that's fine. There are things that need to be done. But to do that, we have to define the enemy. And to do that, we have to be self-assertive. And again, I don't see anybody doing that. Now, the Trump administration has at least moved in a direction. My one positive of the day about Trump, they've at least defined the enemy. They've at least said that radical Islam is the enemy. But now focus on them. And partially, I hope that the extreme vetting really serves that purpose. What I worry about is the fact that from everything I've read, and I've read his actual speeches, Bannon is anti-immigration. He does not want people to come to America, anybody to come to America. And that he will use the notion of extreme vetting to dramatically restrict immigration. Now, I hope I'm wrong, but that's my sense. But so I agree with you about infiltrating. And again, I've been saying this since 9/11, and I agree. Okay, Iran, and this is where I get a lot of this. We can't let the perfect become the enemy of the good. We're going to have to accept solutions that are less perfect, but still move us in the right direction sometime in the near future. 100% agree with you. But this is the key. Move us in the right direction. I have to be convinced, and I am not, that the things that Donald Trump does move us in the right direction. I am not convinced of that at all. I haven't seen anything he's done that, in my view, really, in a deep sense, and over the long term, move us in the right direction. I fear that it's much more of they faking forward and taking two steps backwards. So we think we're going a step forward, but we're actually taking two back. Now, I'm willing to accept that I might be wrong on some of these things, and maybe I'm exaggerating how bad Trump is, and maybe I'm biased and I just don't like him personally and so on, but I don't think that's the case. But it could be. But I agree. I am for solutions and move us forward. I worry, given the nature of the people here, given the nature of Republicans generally, that we're actually moving backwards and not forwards with much of what Donald Trump is doing. All right, the final paragraph is, one solution is a reform movement within Islam itself. You should check out Zudi Jazar's American Islamic Forum, which I am familiar with. He's calling for secular Muslims to oppose radical teaching of Islam. I think you and he could have a profitable exchange of ideas. Look, this is the kind of issue that I've done a lot of work with Daniel Pipes, did a lot of events with Daniel Pipes. Daniel Pipes is big on trying to reform Islam from within. You know, secular Muslims, and I'm supportive of that. I don't think it's a big issue for me. I don't spend a lot of time on that. That's their problem, in a sense, if secular Muslims want to do it. But yeah, I believe, and a lot of objectivists oppose me on this, and I get a lot of hate mail on this, and I'm sure a lot of you on the chat are going to disagree with this. But the fact is, I agree that Islam can be reformed, but it's going to take massive amounts of effort, and it's going to have to come from within Islam. And, you know, it can be reformed, not in a sense that it becomes good, but it becomes less violent. It has its own enlightenment, just like Christianity and Judaism, in a sense, were put in their place by the enlightenment. The same thing has to happen to Islam. It needs to be secularized. And I'm a huge proponent of that and huge supporter of that, and I hope it happens. So, all right, so that's my answer, Tom. That was a lot. So yeah, if you have any follow-ups, go ahead.
Okay. Well, one of the things that you said was that you opposed giving the vetting tool to the government. But who should we give it to?
Well, I'm not opposed.
It's the government's job to vet immigrants.
Yes, but I want that if I'm going to give them a vetting tool, and I agree with you, the government has to do it. Nobody else can do it. I want it to be very, very clearly and narrowly stated. Which, again, the executive order that I was criticizing is not. It's too broad. So I want a narrow vetting for radical Islamists, for violent tendencies and violent ideologies, and that's it. I don't want them to start getting into things like founding principles and understanding of the American way of life. They should center around violation of rights, which means violation of rights in the sense of that individual is going to violate rights. What I worry about is they start focusing on who are they going to vote for. And I know a lot of objectivists would like this, that we limit immigrants to only people who will vote Republican, and we exclude immigrants who vote Democratic, because the idea is if you vote Democratic, you're violating people's rights.
Yeah. Okay. I agree with about 95% of what you're saying. All right.
Okay. Good.
I think the vetting tool should be precisely defined, but it should be done by the State Department.
Yeah, I agree.
The other thing is just the context in which Trump's executive orders came out. Now, we've had 8 years in which Islamic terrorism isn't even mentioned by the government. Okay?
Yep.
So it's about time that the government took notice of it. And Trump
did that. I'll agree that the one thing Trump has done that is good is he's calling it what it is. He's calling it Islamic terrorism. And that is a huge plus, and it's the one thing I will praise him for.
Okay.
And by the way, it's not 8 years; it's 16 years. Well, 15 years, because George W. Bush never called them Islamic terrorists, except for 1 week. There was 1 week, I can't remember the year, where he floated the idea that they're Islamo-fascists, and there was such a backlash against that, including from Republicans, that he stopped it. But even, I mean, everybody likes to load up on Obama. And I've said this on the show. I hate, and I'm not saying he was worse. I hate George W. Bush more than I do Obama. And Bush started this of appeasement of Islam while going to war with them, which was a bizarre combination. And Obama just followed Bush's lead. But Obama didn't do anything that Bush did not start.
No, Obama put it on steroids.
Yeah, I agree. But Bush is the one who got it going. Bush was the appeaser. Bush was the moderate. Bush is the one who had people from CARE coming to the White House to celebrate Ramadan, just a few weeks after 9/11. Bush was the ultimate appeaser. And because he did it from the right, it was so much more powerful. But even in economics, Bush had a $300 billion, stimulus package. Obama had a $900 billion. Bush bailed out these institutions. Obama bailed out those institutions. Obama just took everything Bush did and put them a little bit on steroids. But Bush is the most bad idea.
No, Obama put the whole thing on steroids. He was the worst president in American history.
Yeah, we disagree on that, Tom.
We'll have to.
I think Wilson was much worse, and the consequences of the Wilsonian presidency are going to be a thousand times worse than anything. Obama was incompetent, and at the end of the day, did very little because of the Republican House and Senate. Wilson did a lot, and changed the whole dynamic of American politics forever. FDR was a lot worse than Obama, and in terms of damage to America, President Johnson was a lot worse than Obama. You know, think about Medicare, Medicaid, war and poverty, welfare, the Vietnam War, the tens of thousands of Americans who died there, the crime rates, the assassinations of the 1960s. I mean, the cultural decay in the 1960s. I mean, Johnson was horrific. So,
we're seeing the same cultural decay today.
We're not nowhere near the same proportion as it was back then. I look around America today and I don't see as many riots as there are today. They don't come anywhere close to the burning down of Watts in the 1960s, to the Woodstock and everything that it represented today. I mean, yes, what you saw in Berkeley was horrific and horrible, but it is one event relative to that was happening almost weekly during 1968. That was happening everywhere in that era. So in many respects, and rates of violence in the 60s, in the late 60s and 70s, far higher than they are today in the United States. So in many respects, and the culture is still in the same direction of decay. But I think things were worse in the 70s than they are today in many respects.
Yeah, they were. But I'm afraid that America is going in that direction again.
I agree with you. And I agree with you. And I think I fear that Trump won't make it any better. In a sense, he'll make it worse. But
yeah,
thanks, Tom. I really, really appreciated the question. It was a good question and it covered a lot of ground and a lot of issues that I think a lot of people had with some of my podcasts. So I got to clarify a lot of issues. So thank you for the opportunity.
Take care.
You too. All right. We got one more call here and then I want to go back to economic nationalism. Hi, you're on the Ron Brooks Show. Who's this? North Carolina, I think, 336.
Oh, this is Evan from North Carolina.
Hey, Evan, how's it going?
And this is a question about economic nationalism. So
good.
So I keep hearing, Donald Trump is a leftist. Donald Trump is a leftist. Is this economic nationalism, are these policies, these tariffs, has this been part of the American left position ever? Well, I mean,
yeah. Always. Always. I mean,
well, the Democratic Party, because, I mean, this isn't. I know Bernie Sanders has been anti-free trade, some of the more far left. Has this been like a mainstream Democrat position?
Some Democrats, sure. So it wasn't a mainstream Democrat position since Clinton, because Clinton moved the Democratic Party on economic issues to the center, and particularly when it came to trade, and Democrats in the center tended to listen to their economic advisors. And if you look at like leftist economists, even like Paul Krugman won a Nobel Prize for work he had done 30 years ago on the benefits of international trade. And almost all economists believe international trade is good. There's almost no economist who don't. So the centers of both parties, who kind of tend to listen to some economics, not all, but some economic sense, were all for free trade, because their economic advisors were all recommending free trade. But if you look out to the more radical left, or the progressive left, or the regressive left, the Bernie Sanders people, they have always been anti-trade and indeed anti-immigration. Bernie Sanders is anti-immigration. He, in an interview, I forget with who, but in an interview at the beginning of the campaign, he was asked about open borders, and he said, you know, God forbid open borders. That's a Koch brothers proposal. I'm not for open borders. Open borders destroy unions and they lower wages, and it's bad for the American worker to have open borders. I don't want immigration. And I think the guy I was interviewing was a lefty, was shocked by Bernie Sanders saying that. That's always been the progressive, the leftist portion of the Democratic Party's position. And whenever there's been a free trade bill like NAFTA, or like free trade deals like that, the extreme left and the extreme right always voted against it, and the people who voted for it were the people kind of in the middle, right? The moderate Republicans and the moderate Democrats. Go ahead.
Do you think Democrats are going to cooperate with them in this, or do you think that they're just so wildly anti-Trump that they're going to put the shoe in the other foot?
I think they'll actually cooperate with them on trade issues. I think the Democrats are idiots. I think if they play their cards right, I think, both parties are pretty stupid. But if they play their cards right, they will get some of their agenda passed by Trump, because I do think on these issues, he's a lefty. So I think Democrats have always been pro-tariffs. They've always been pro-American workers, which is, you know, this collectivistic idea of American workers. And they could, for example, I think that if Democrats sat down with Trump, I think they could get a pro-union bill passed in Congress. I think that Donald Trump, at the end of the day, if really pushed, is going to be pro-unions, because I think he and Bannon perceive unions as part of this Bannon's view of the Judeo-Christian view of capitalism, and the importance of unions and American workers and protecting American workers and all that BS that they talk about. So I think they can get, I don't think they'll support Trump on immigration, because they have positioned themselves as getting the Hispanic vote by being pro-Hispanic immigration. But I think that if you look at unions have always been anti-immigration, And they actually killed, when George W. Bush, one of the few good things he wanted to do was kind of a comprehensive immigration reform in 2006, I think. And the people who killed that were not the Republicans. It was the Democrats. The Democrats wouldn't sign up. And that comprehensive immigration reform would have legalized many of the illegal immigrants, would have opened up the borders in more significant ways. And it's Democrats who killed it because of the unions. They were afraid to lose the union vote. So American politics is complicated in that sense, because there is no left and right in any fundamental sense. They're all collectivists. And the essence of collectivism is gang politics, gang warfare politics. So it's my gang versus your gang. So the Democrats have all kinds of gangs they have to appease. They've got the unions, who are anti-immigration, and then they've got the Hispanics, who are pro-immigration, and then they've got the wealthy elites in Hollywood and other places who are pro other things, and they've got all these gangs and they constantly have to balance the thing. And the same with the Republicans. They've got the religious right, so they have to make a big deal out of religion. And they've got the nativists, the anti-immigration, build a wall, those kind of people. And then they've got the cronies, the corporate leaders who are you know, and each gang is fighting for its own. So all of the politics today is basically gang warfare, identity politics. It's all about different gangs and different groups and what kind of, who can we sacrifice for the sake of whom, and who gets to win today and who gets to lose. And that's what American politics has devolved into. And that's why I don't care about left or right. I think that, you know, I think it's all garbage. The real political spectrum is individualism versus collectivism. And all of these guys on left and right are fundamentally collectivists. I know we got way away from your question, I think.
Well, that's no problem.
So go ahead. If you have anything else, I'll return to some of this stuff.
How much of an impact is this going to have? In one of your shows, you said 2017, your prediction, the economy is good. The economy does well. How much of an impact is this going to have if it gets pushed through? I mean,
well, to the extent that Trump is successful in passing all the things he wants to pass that one could characterize as economic nationalism, dramatic restrictions on immigration, dramatic restrictions on trade, bringing the jobs back by, I mean, I've got a quote here. Let me find this quote from Navarro, who is Trump's trade guy. And he says, the priority is to unwind and repatriate the international supply chains on which many U.S. companies rely. So the idea here is bring those into, you know, we have today, when you look at an iPhone, it's got thousands of parts made in hundreds of different companies in dozens of different countries. What Navarro is basically saying, we need to consolidate all those supply chains and bring them all back to the United States. Now, let me say, if you try to do that, you are basically going to spiral, and I don't care what else you do, you are going to bring about another Great Depression. This is because today, trade is a cornerstone of the global economy. It is what compensates us for all the horrible regulations and the high taxes that we have. The one bright spot in the world today is the tariffs are historically at some of the lowest rates ever, maybe the lowest rates ever. So in spite of all the cronyism, average tariffs in and out of the United States are the lowest they've ever been. And that compensates us for the fact that our businesses are so regulated and so taxed. So our standard of living rises because of trade and declines because of all these tariffs and so on. So what these idiots want to do is they want to destroy the one positive good aspect of the U.S. economy today, which is trade. And think about Silicon Valley, whose supply chains are completely dependent on international trade. Think what would happen to Microsoft and Cisco and Apple and even Google and companies like that if this economic nationalism really played out, or Walmart or the steel companies in the United States that benefit from massive amounts of cheap steel today. It's just unthinkable the kind of economic disaster that these people, Donald Trump could inflict on this country.
Oh, interesting answer.
What's that? Sure. Thanks for calling. Yeah. Really appreciate it. Thanks for listening. And sorry to be so pessimistic. But trade is that important. And these people are putzing around with something. It's like they've got their finger on a nuclear bomb. And they're going, I might slip it. I might not. Hey, what's going on? Right? You know, and they're talking about they will create a new political movement that focuses on jobs, that focuses on – and this is Bannon. This is Bannon speaking. Here's a quote from Bannon. Like Andrew Jackson's populism, we're going to build an entirely new political movement. It's everything related to jobs. The conservatives are going to go crazy. The free market conservatives. I'm the guy pushing a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. Bannon is pushing a $1 trillion infrastructure plan. I mean, what's the difference between him and a Democrat and the left? A $1 trillion infrastructure plan. with negative interest rates throughout the world. It's the greatest opportunity to rebuild everything. At whose expense? Shipyards, ironworks, get them all jacked up. I mean, this guy is a Keynesian, you know, nationalist. We're just going to throw it all up against the wall and see if it sticks. It will be as exciting as the 1930s. As exciting as the 1930s. What were the 1930s? FDR socialism. FDR nationalism and the rise of fascism all over the world. Really? We want to get exciting like the 30s? I'm throwing stuff. Right? I don't know. I don't know what to make of this. I don't know what to make of you guys supporting this crap. Greater than Reagan Revolution. Well, of course, Reagan Revolution was pretty minor. Conservatives plus populists in an economic nationalist movement. That is the number one advisor to President Trump. Right? Exciting as the 1930s. 1930s that led immediately to World War II. I'm surprised he doesn't say as exciting as the 1940s, you know, where we got to go to war. We got to go to war. What's more manly than going to war? In the name of our nation, what's more exciting than that? Who did I get a strangle today? All right. Sorry. I'm losing it here. All right. So, and of course, you know, Bannon is not just as populist. He's also very religious, and it's all about the decline in Christian tradition and the rise of secularism, and the evil is secular. And I don't know who we go to war with. Hopefully we don't go to war. Hopefully we can avoid it. But at the end of the day, that's what nationalism always leads to. Always. The rise of economic nationalism always leads to it. Let me talk quickly about economic nationalism. And let me refer you to an excellent article. It was by Richard Ebeling. Richard is an Austrian economist who teaches at the Citadel. He's a friend. We disagree on some things. But this article is excellent. It appears in the Future Freedom Foundation, and it's called The Economic Nationalism of Donald Trump by Richard Ebeling, E-B-E-L-I-N-G, The Economic Nationalism of Donald Trump by Richard Ebeling, and it's excellent. And he talks about what does economic nationalism mean? Well, nationalism is the doctrine, and he's quoting here from somebody who wrote in those exciting 1930s, because in those exciting 1930s, a lot of people were concerned about nationalism because they could see it happening. This is in an essay in 1937 by William Rappard on economic nationalism. And he writes, nationalism is the doctrine which places the nation at the top of the scale of political values. That is above three rival values of the individual, the regional unit, and the international community. So think about this. Economic nationalism is Donald Trump, right? We place the individual above everything. So we represent one alternative, which is individual. Regional units is like state rights. The smaller unit, the state, is the highest, not the nation, but the state political value. And the fourth is the international community. That's the globalists who want international government. I mean, the globalists in the negative sense, not in terms of globalization, which I'm very much for, but the people who want the UN to run everything and the international community is what's important, and we should be sacrificing ourselves for the poor in godforsaken places all around the world. So he wrote this in 1937, and that was exactly the way you would divide people up today. You could divide people up today. Economic nationalists, the Donald Trump types, the regionalists, the kind of conservative state rights who have no concept of what individual rights really mean, and the internationalists who wants us all to sacrifice for the sake of people far, far away. And the real alternative to all of that are the individualists, the people who believe the individual in the individual, and the individual as the basic moral and political unit and economic unit. Economic nationalism is defined, according to this article, by its underlying purpose. We should say that it was a doctrine destined to serve the nation by making it not richer, but freer of foreign influence. So not freer in terms of freedom, freer in terms of less influence from foreign forces, right? So it's by promoting its material welfare, not that, but it's independence from foreign influence. So the whole idea of economic nationalism is not to get richer. It's not to make your own citizens more prosperous. It's to be independent from foreign influence, foreign impact, and really to establish national self-sufficiency. This is the whole, we want to be energy independent nonsense. We want everything to be produced in America by American, because we want to produce everything in America. And in 1937, this author says what a ridiculous thing that is. And what he says, what it always does, he says, as no measure of restricting of imports, of stimulating whole products, and of territorial expansion can possibly make any state entirely self-sufficient under modern conditions, economic nationalism seeks, fourthly, to secure a positive balance of trade. But he says that's ridiculous. So ultimately, what economic nationalism does is impoverish your own country. Impoverish your own country. All right. So, that is economic nationalism. It's about restricting on imports, stimulating home products, and ultimately says because that makes you poor, the economic nationalist then try to conquer other countries to accept it. But it impoverishes yourself, right? Sorry, if I used the wrong word. It impoverishes the country you're actually trying to help. So, all right. So this is completely anti-American. This whole attitude is completely anti-American. This whole perspective of nationalism is anti-American. America is about looking at things from an individualist perspective, right? And so all this stuff about trade, I mean, it's just ignorant, but it's worse than ignorant. It is actually evil, because it is actually, again, going to make us poorer in the name of nationalism, in the name of bringing jobs back, in the name of I don't know what. In the name of national greatness, it'll result in national depression. So there's no economist who believes that NAFTA was bad for America. We get lower tariffs. Now, you could argue that it's not as good as it could be. It could be much better because it could lower tariffs even more. Absolutely. Absolutely. NAFTA could be a lot better. But it's pretty good. And it's TPP was full of crony stuff. And that's bad. But it also lowered tariffs on a lot of stuff. Remember, we talked with Tom before about steps in the right direction. NAFTA is a huge step in the right direction. TPP might have been a small step in the right direction, but it was in the right direction. It was in the direction of lower tariffs at the expense of cronyism. I hate cronyism, but you know what? Lower tariffs are probably more valuable. We'll fight cronyism another day. And then there's all manipulating a business and everything else that Trump is doing, the carrier deal, that all the tax benefits to this group because I like you and we're going to increase taxes on that group because I don't like you. The central planning, the whole attitude is unbelievable. And then the wall, the idea that immigrants are the enemy is, I mean, I'll talk about immigration more in weeks to come. And I don't know if you know, but I'm doing this debate on Amy Peacock's show. You can listen to Amy Peacock's show on Blog Talk Radio with Lindsay Piggio. I don't know if I mispronounced that, who is anti-immigration. We'll see. And pro-Trump. And we're debating, I think, mostly immigration on Friday on Amy Peacock's show. So if you want to hear that, but yeah, you can. And of course, all of it, we're ultimately going to sacrifice individual rights for national safety, which brings me back to the ban, because I have to comment on this judge and the response of this judge. Now, I'm not a legal scholar. I do not know if this judge is within his power or not. And the beauty of it is that we have a legal system. And indeed, the Justice Department appealed this to eliminate the judge just ordered on Friday that the ban on people coming in, Muslims coming in, be lifted nationwide. And you know, it's, I don't know if that's within his rights. I assume it is. That's what our legal system is there to do. It's there to stop the president and Congress from doing things that the judiciary believes are unconstitutional. And we have a complex system of appeals, of Congress could pass laws, all kinds of things in order to restrict power. This is a healthy, good thing. So I think the fact that the judge did this, I don't view it as a negative. And immigrants are not pouring into this country. You know, 99.9% of the Muslims coming into this country are not going to become terrorists. There's little evidence of that. They were pouring in quotes, before the ban it went into effect. So a few more days is not going to make that big of a difference. But the fact is that, you know, this judge did it. It's supposedly within his power. The Justice Department went to one of the appellate courts this weekend to try to have an emergency lifting of the restriction on the ban. And the appellate court said no. So obviously the appellate court thinks the judge has the authority to do this. And we are now going to see this go through the appellate process. And I think very quickly to go through the process, and the appeals courts will evaluate whether this is within the authority of the president or not. And that's the way it should be. That is how America functions. That is what Americanism means. It means the separation of powers. It means we limit government. It means we give the judiciary authority to say, no, president, fill in the blank. You can't do that. That's the beauty of the American system. And then this is the outrageous thing. Not what the judge did, but what Donald Trump did in his tweet Saturday morning or Saturday sometime, where he called the judge who did this, the so-called judge. Now, I talked about this yesterday, and you'll hear it, so I'm not going to talk a lot about this. But that is despicable. I'm sorry. Every time I try to say, okay, I'm going to try to be positive this week about Donald Trump, he does something like this. An American president can criticize judicial things. Obama did that to the Supreme Court. And by the way, Republicans and people on the right and objectives flipped out when Obama criticized the Supreme Court, as we should have. It's the highest court of the land. You got to respect their opinions. You can criticize them intellectually, but you do it intellectually. And Obama didn't. Now Donald Trump calls this judge a so-called judge. A so-called judge, the president of the United States. What would happen if he loses in the Supreme Court? What's going to happen when judges rule against him, which they should on some cases? I mean, this is the exact authoritarianism Ankur Gatta and I have been warning you about. And the fact that objectivists don't call this out, the fact that objectivists are just willing to accept anything Donald Trump does, just proves my point. This is despicable. This should be called out. This is maybe one of the worst things he's done to date. You cannot call a judge who's appointed as a judge. You can say, I disagree with the judge. The judge made a mistake and will prove it in the appellate court. There is a process for this, but you do not call him a so-called judge. But basically, you're undercutting, you're denying the legitimacy of the judiciary process, and that is anti-American, which I have claimed all along Donald Trump is an anti-American president. Not in the same sense that Obama was. Obama was an anti-American in the sense that he didn't believe in America, didn't love America. Trump loves America, but he has no clue what America is. No clue. And his actual policies are destructive to America, But I talk about that. I talk about this so-called judge a lot more in my Chicago show, which you can listen to in a couple of days online. Unfortunately, on the Facebook Live, it got cut up and the connection wasn't very good. All right. So I want to talk a little bit about what Trump has done. So first of all, let me be clear. Economic nationalism and America do not go together. They are opposites. They clash. America equals individualism. This president doesn't have a clue what individualism is. Bannon, who seems to be the most powerful of his advisors, has declared himself to be an economic nationalist. I have quote upon quote upon quote of Bannon saying this. He admires nationalism. You heard the quote about the exciting 1930s. This is very, very dangerous stuff. Okay, but people say, Yaron, he's done so many good things in the first 2 weeks. Nobody could have expected a president of the United States to do so many good things. So first of all, you can call in with good things that Donald Trump has done, because I can't remember that many. 347-324-3075. We've got 10 minutes for this. I forgot to prepare a movie or a TV, or although I could pull out something from otherwise to end on a positive note. But let me, I just want to, maybe this is a positive note, although it won't be in the end. Trying to find positive things that Donald Trump has done. Now, don't give me that the major positive is that he's not Hillary Clinton. We know that, right? She lost. He won. He's who we have to deal with. He approved the pipelines. Now, I have to admit, I've never understood this. I've never understood why Republicans and a lot of other people made such a big deal of pipelines. I mean, I think it's terrible that Obama got involved and rejected them. But why is this such a big deal? Government regulations and government controls probably stop productive activity every single day. Why are the pipelines special? Not only that, I suspect that these pipelines are going to involve massive violations of property rights, because they're all going to involve eminent domain. And Trump has actually said, when he approved the pipelines, he said, yay, we're going to use eminent domain. People criticize me about eminent domain, but yay, we're going to go and use eminent domain. I mean, great, he approved the pipelines. Good for him. I don't see it's a big deal. I don't think it has much of an economic impact. I don't think it's that important. By the way, one of the provisions in his executive order, and this is the evil that even when he does good, he creates evil, is that the pipelines have to be built with American-made steel. That's damn un-American and evil and bad and should be rejected by anybody who knows one bit of economics. So, you know, pipelines. Okay. So he turned back something bad that Obama did. This is important. A lot of people, oh, wow, we're building the pipeline. Why? Who cares? Right? Pipelines should be private things. People want to build pipelines. It should be allowed to build pipelines without using eminent domain. They should be build the pipelines if that's what's efficient for them. Government should stay out of it. Identifying two specific pipelines and the president to approve them or disapprove them. I mean, it's good that they're not being disapproved. Yeah. All right. I talked about the appointments. I'm not going to repeat the appointments. A lot of the appointments are good. I think probably the best thing about Donald Trump so far was some of his appointments. I think there's a number of people who've been appointed, you know, people like, you know, two particular places. Betsy DeVos, the education secretary, is probably good, although I even there I'm worried. Why am I worried? Because there's very little you can do at the national level with regard to education that's good. You can dismantle a lot of stuff, but anything positive is typically going to be bad. Education right now is at the state level. It should stay at the state level. The battle for freedom in education should be at the states, not at the federal level, because the federal government doesn't do much. So my fear is that what they're going to do is expand the role of the federal government in education in order to try to impose so-called free market solutions on education. I don't think they can do that. I think we'll see. I hope I'm wrong. I hope Betsy DeVos does something good. Anyway, I think there are a number of appointments that are good. I don't think the ban was good. I've talked about this because of its scope and because of the way it emphasized ideology and because of it identifies seven countries that are not the key countries and all the problems with this ban. It's just a silly ban. Let me just say, I think the pipelines and the ban and a lot of what Donald Trump is doing, he's doing to appease his base. He's doing it to say to the base, see, I did it, rather than these being good things and being very helpful things. The other one that people are excited about, oh my God, for every new regulation that's passed, two regulations are going to be cut. I can't get excited about that. Sorry. Partially because why are we passing any new regulations? And secondly, because one versus two, but this isn't a numerical game. I know regulations that could basically cripple whole industries, and you could eliminate two regulations that are irrelevant to anybody. this is about quality, not quantity. It's not a numbers game. I want massive deregulation. I want whole regulatory bills like Dodd-Frank, which he started tinkering with. But I don't want tinkering with it. I want them eliminated. I want Obamacare gone. I want Sarbanes-Oxley gone. I even want the old Glass-Steagall gone. Only a portion of it is being eliminated. I want the whole thing gone, right? I want big, and I know some of you are going to say, well, you're on. That's so ideal. You know, that can happen. You have to live in the real world. Well, no, I'm going to define what we need to do. And you guys put pressure on them to do. But two for one, I mean, it's kind of in the right direction, but it's just the fact that it's about numbers suggests to me this is what the regulators will do. I know how regulators function. They'll introduce a new regulation that's meaningful, and they'll scrap two regulations that haven't probably been applied to the industry in 45 years because there's so many regulations in the book that go back 100 years. So, you know, I don't know how you guys take this stuff seriously. I don't know if it's naivete or this authoritarian that you just want something to get done. Okay, here's something good that Donald Trump has done that I embrace, right? The EPA, it looks like he's cutting staff. It looks like they're not going to take this whole global warming seriously. It looks like they're going to restructure it all. Cool. I'm all for that. To the extent that they do stuff like that, good. And, you know, I just hope they follow through. I hope they do it right. And I hope they expand it from the EPA to a bunch of other agencies. All right, we've got one caller. Maybe he has something else good that Donald Trump's done that I am not familiar with. Hi, you're in the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, Iran. It's been a while. This is Dave from Portland, Oregon.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
Good, good. I hope you don't mind if I just plant a seed and jump off. I'm driving in some funky weather out here.
Joe, no, I've only got 3 minutes. So plant the seed quickly and feel free to jump off.
Okay. The question is, and I think you actually just started to touch on it, is bringing back, repealing at least some of Dodd-Frank. That was, I'm not a Trump fan by any stretch, but that was just something that I wonder if you might comment on and some of the fear mongering of the left in terms of actually taking back some of Dodd-Frank.
Yeah, so the left, of course, is going to try to clamp onto any regulation, any controls that they can. And so it's BS. But also, but what Trump is proposing so far is pretty minor. The fiduciary rule is just one minor aspect of Dodd-Frank. It's important, and getting rid of it would be good. And I'll talk more about it in a future show because I don't have the time to really get deep into Dodd-Frank. But Dodd-Frank is a big, big monster, and it needs to be thoughtfully and carefully dismantled. And at the same time, we need to make clear what we're going to do about too-big-to-fail banks, how we're going to get out of too-big-to-fail, what are we going to replace too-big-to-fail with. And that's going to require a very complex process of deregulation. There's some pretty good stuff in Congress to do that, and I hope that Donald Trump ultimately supports that. And the best person to do all this would be John Allison from BB&T and formerly the head of the Cato Institute. So I would suggest that Donald Trump make John Allison financial deregulation czar. You remember those czars that Obama created?
I do.
Financial deregulation czar. And that John be responsible for the systematic deregulation of the financial industry over the next 4 years. Now, if he did that, I would praise that idea and that nomination, particularly if they actually let John do what he wants to do. I would really praise that. But, you know, let's wait and see if that happens. I guess there's still a possibility that will happen, but we're going to have to wait and see. All right, we'll do a whole show on Dodd-Frank. Add that to the list of all the shows I promised you guys that I haven't fulfilled. Thanks, Dave. Thanks for calling. And thank you all guys for listening. We're close to wrapping up here. And you know, somebody mentioned Alex Noreste. I don't know how to pronounce his name, from Cato. He writes for them on immigration. And I think his work on immigration is excellent. I quote him often, and he gets a lot of data, and he produces a lot of data, and he's excellent. So on the issues of immigration. I'm far closer on those issues to Cato than I am to anything Trump and anything other people are doing. Although I think they miss some of the Islamic issues because they're soft on the terrorism issues, and they take them too lightly. And I'm a lot tougher on Islamic terrorism. All right. Thank you all for listening. You have been listening to Iran Book Show. We will talk to you next week, where I'm sure we will have lots of new stuff to talk about. See you next week.